KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
You're listening to live special coverage from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Tonight, President Joe Biden says goodbye. The president is delivering a farewell address from the Oval Office. It's a presidential tradition dating back to George Washington, a final speech where a president often takes stock of his accomplishments in office and at times issues stark warnings about the challenges still facing the country. I'm joined in studio by NPR White House correspondent Asma Khalid. Hey, Asma.
Hey there. It's great to be with you.
It's really good to be with you. And look, President Biden is not leaving the office the way he wanted, right? He cut short a reelection campaign. His vice president, Kamala Harris, lost to Donald Trump. Donald Trump is returning to the White House.
Mm-hmm.
But tonight, Biden is delivering the speech having accomplished something he has worked long and hard for, and that is a ceasefire agreement in Gaza.
That's right. We got news of this just earlier today that a framework that Biden actually did articulate back in May at the White House, it was there back in May when he did, outline this framework for a ceasefire hostage deal should go into effect on Sunday. And the White House was eager to point out that this is something Biden had been pitching for many months. Biden said that this was one of the most difficult negotiations he has ever experienced. Of course, Scott, the big question is how involved Donald Trump was in all of this happening.
Right. So I expect we will hear about Israel and Gaza tonight. We'll also, I'm sure, hear about infrastructure spending, many other big moments from Biden's presidency. We're going to go now to the Oval Office, where President Joe Biden will be delivering this address from the Resolute Desk.
My fellow Americans, I'm speaking to you tonight from the Oval Office. Before I begin, let me speak to important news from earlier today. After 8 months of nonstop negotiation, by my administration, a ceasefire and a hostage deal has been reached by Israel and Hamas, the elements of which I laid out in great detail in May of this year. This plan was developed and negotiated by my team and will be largely implemented by the incoming administration. That's why I told my team to keep the incoming administration fully informed, because that's how it should be, working together as Americans. This will be my final address to you from the American people, from the Oval Office, from this desk as president. And I've been thinking a lot about who we are, and maybe more importantly, who we should be. Long ago, in New York Harbor, an iron worker installed beam after beam, day after day. He was joined by steel workers, stonemasons, engineers. They built not just a single structure, but a beacon of freedom. The very idea of America was so big, we felt the entire world needed to see. The Statue of Liberty, a gift from France after our Civil War. Like the very idea of America, it was built not by one person, but by many people, from every background and from around the world. Like America, the Statue of Liberty is not standing still. Her foot literally steps forward atop a broken chain of human bondage. She's on the march, and she literally moves. She was built to sway back and forth to withstand the fury of stormy weather, to stand the test of time because storms are always coming. She sways a few inches, but she never falls into the current below, an engineering marvel. The Statue of Liberty is also an enduring symbol of the soul of our nation, a soul shaped by forces that bring us together and by forces that pull us apart. And yet through good times and tough times, we've withstood it all. A nation of pioneers and explorers, of dreamers and doers, of ancestors native to this land, of ancestors who came by force, a nation of immigrants came to build a better life, a nation holding the torch of the most powerful idea ever in the history of the world, that all of us are created equal, that all of us deserve to be treated with dignity, justice and fairness, that democracy must defend and be defined and be imposed, moved in every way possible. Our rights, our freedoms, our dreams. But we know the idea of America, our institution, our people, our values that uphold it are constantly being tested. Ongoing debates about power and the exercise of power, but whether we lead by the example of our power or the power of our example. Whether we show the courage to stand up to the abuse of power or we yield to it. After 50 years at the center of all of this, I know that believing in the idea of America means respecting the institutions that govern a free society. The presidency, the Congress, the courts, a free and independent press. Institutions that are rooted, not they just might not reflect the timeless words, but they echo the words of the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident. Rooted in the timeless words of the Constitution, we the people. Our system of separation of powers, checks and balances. It may not be perfect, but it's maintained our democracy for nearly 250 years, longer than any other nation in history that's ever tried such a bold experiment. In the past 4 years, our democracy has held strong. And every day I've kept my commitment to be president for all Americans through one of the toughest periods in our nation's history. I've had a great partner in Vice President Kamala Harris. It's been the honor of my life to see the resilience of essential workers getting us through a once-in-a-century pandemic, the heroism of service members and first responders keeping us safe, the determination of advocates standing up for our rights and our freedoms instead of losing their jobs to an economic crisis that we inherited. Millions of Americans now have the dignity of work. Millions of entrepreneurs and companies creating new businesses and industries, hiring American workers, using American products. And together, we've launched a new era of American possibilities. One of the greatest modernizations of infrastructure in our entire history, from new roads, bridges, clean water, affordable high-speed internet for every American. We invented the semiconductor, smaller than the tip of my little finger, and now is bringing those chip factories and those jobs back to America where they belong, creating thousands of jobs. Finally, giving Medicare the power to negotiate lower prescription drug prices for millions of seniors. And finally, doing something to protect our children and our families by passing the most significant gun safety law in 30 years and bringing violent crime to a 50-year low. Meeting our sacred obligation to over 1 million veterans so far who are exposed to toxic materials and to their families, providing medical care and education benefits and more for their families. You know, it will take time to feel the full impact of all we've done together. But the seeds are planted, and they'll grow and they'll bloom for decades to come. At home, we've created nearly 17 million new jobs, more than any other single administration, single term. More people have health care than ever before. And overseas, we've strengthened NATO. Ukraine is still free. And we've pulled ahead of our competition with China. And so much more. I'm so proud of how much we've accomplished together for the American people. And I wish the incoming administration success, because I want America to succeed. That's why I have held my duty to ensure a peaceful and orderly transition of power, to ensure we lead by the power of our example. I have no doubt that America is in a position to continue to succeed. That's why my farewell address tonight, I want to warn the country of some things that give me great concern. And this is a dangerous concentration, and that's a dangerous concentration of power in the hands of a very few ultra-wealthy people. And the dangerous consequences if their abuse of power is left unchecked. Today, an oligarchy is taking shape in America of extreme wealth, power, and influence that literally threatens our entire democracy, our basic rights and freedoms, and a fair shot for everyone to get ahead. We see the consequences all across America, and we've seen it before. More than a century ago, but the American people stood up to the robber barons back then and busted the trusts. They didn't punish the wealthy. just made the wealthy play by the rules everybody else had to. Workers want rights to earn their fair share. You know, they were dealt into the deal and helped put us on a path to building the largest middle class, the most prosperous century any nation in the world has ever seen. And we've got to do that again. In the last 4 years, that is exactly what we've done. People should be able to make as much as they can, but play by the same rules, pay their fair share of taxes. So much is at stake. Right now, the existential threat of climate change has never been clearer. Just look across the country, from California to North Carolina. That's why I signed the most significant climate and clean energy law ever, ever in the history of the world, and the rest of the world is trying to model it now. It's working, creating jobs and industries of the future. Now, we've proven we don't have to choose between protecting the environment and growing the economy. We're doing both. The powerful forces want to wield their unchecked influence to eliminate the steps we've taken to tackle the climate crisis, to serve their own interest for power and profit. We must not be bullied into sacrificing the future of our children and our grandchildren. We must keep pushing forward and push faster. There's no time to waste. It's also clear that American leadership in technology is an unparalleled source of innovation that can transform lives. We see the same dangers of the concentration of technology, power, and wealth. You know, his farewell address, President Eisenhower spoke of the dangers of the military-industrial complex. He warned us then about, and I quote, the potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power, end of quote. Six decades later, I'm equally concerned about the potential rise of a tech industrial complex that could pose real dangers for our country as well. Americans are being buried under an avalanche of misinformation and disinformation, enabling the abuse of power. The free press is crumbling. Editors are disappearing. Social media is giving up on fact-checking. The truth is smothered by lies told for power and for profit. We must hold the social platforms accountable to protect our children, our families, and our very democracy from the abuse of power. Meanwhile, artificial intelligence is the most consequential technology of our time, perhaps of all time. Nothing offers more profound possibilities and risk for our economy, and our security, our society, for humanity. Artificial intelligence even has the potential to help us answer my call to end cancer as we know it. But unless safeguards are in place, AI could spawn new threats to our rights, our way of life, to our privacy, how we work and how we protect our nation. We must make sure AI is safe and trustworthy and good for all humankind. In the age of AI, it's more important than ever that the people must govern. And as the land of liberty, America, not China, must lead the world in the development of AI. You know, in the years ahead, it's going to be up to the president, the presidency, the Congress, the courts, the free press, and the American people to confront these powerful forces. We must reform the tax code, not by giving the biggest tax cuts to billionaires, but by making them begin to pay their fair share. We need to get dark money. That's that hidden funding behind too many campaign contributions. We need to get it out of our politics. We need to enact an 18-year term limit, for the strongest ethics reforms for our Supreme Court. We need to ban members of Congress from trading stock while they're in the Congress. We need to amend the Constitution to make clear that no president is immune from crimes that he or she commits while in office. The president's power is not limited. It's not absolute, and it shouldn't be. And in a democracy, there's another danger. to the concentration of power and wealth. It erodes a sense of unity and common purpose. It causes distrust and division. Participating in our democracy becomes exhausting and even disillusioning. And people don't feel like they have a fair shot. We have to stay engaged in the process. I know it's frustrating. A fair shot is what makes America, America. Everyone's entitled to a fair shot. Not a guarantee, but just a fair shot. An even playing field. Going as far as your hard work and talent can take you. We can never lose that essential truth. Remain who we are. I've always believed, and I've told other world leaders, America can be defined by one word, possibilities. Only in America do we believe anything is possible. Like a kid with a stutter from modest beginnings in Scranton, Pennsylvania, in Claymont, Delaware, sitting behind this desk in the Oval Office as President of the United States. That's the magic of America. It's all around us. Upstairs in the residence of the White House, I've walked by a painting of the Statue of Liberty, I don't know how many times. In the painting, there's several workers climbing on the outstretched arm of the statue that holds the torch. It reminds me every day I pass it of the story and soul of our nation and the power of the American people. There's a story of a veteran. This is a veteran, a son of an immigrant, whose job was to climb that torch and polish the amber panes so rays of light could reach out as far as possible. He was known as the Keeper of the Flame. He once said of the Statue of Liberty, quote, speaks a silent universal language, one of hope, that anyone who seeks and speaks freedom can understand. Yes, we sway back and forth to withstand the fury of the storm, to stand the test of time. A constant struggle, a short distance between peril and possibility. But what I believe is the America of our dreams is always closer than we think. It's up to us to make our dreams come true. Let me close by stating my gratitude to so many people, to the members of my administration, as well as public service and first responders across the country and around the world. Thank you for stepping up to serve. To our service members and your families, it's been the highest honor of my life to lead you as Commander-in-Chief. And of course to Kamala and her incredible partner, the historic Vice President. She and Doug have become like family. And to me, family's everything. My deepest appreciation to our amazing First Lady who's with me in the Oval today. For our entire family. You're the love of my life and the lives of my love. My eternal thanks to you, the American people. After 50 years of public service, I give you my word. I still believe in the idea for which this nation stands. A nation where the strength of our institutions and the character of our people matter and must endure. Now it's your turn to stand guard. May you all be the keeper of the flame. May you keep the faith. I love America. You love it too. God bless you all. May God protect our troops. Thank you for this great honor.
You are listening to live special coverage from NPR News. We just heard President Biden delivering his farewell address. He began and ended the speech with images of the Statue of Liberty and the diverse group of workers who built it. Biden touted his accomplishments, and he also, in the tradition of farewell addresses, delivered stark warnings about the dangers of climate change, technology, and extreme wealth, saying at one point that an oligarchy is taking shape in America. I'm Scott Detrow, and I'm joined in studio by my colleague, NPR White House correspondent Asma Khalid. Hey, Asma.
Hi there.
I want to start with the warnings, and let's start with the one about an oligarchy, saying that extreme power in the hands of the few is a danger to this country, and saying this at a time when Donald Trump is taking office, flanked throughout the transition by the wealthiest man in the world, Elon Musk, Feels particularly notable to hear this from Biden.
It does, and it really does feel like a fundamental shift also from where the Democratic Party was, say, 8, 12 years ago during the Obama years, where we saw a real close nexus, I would say, between the Democratic Party and the tech community. Biden went on to say today, he spoke about a tech industrial complex, said he was particularly worried about that sort of abuse of power, as you say, from the ultra-wealthy, but singled out that industry in particular, yeah. Went on then to discuss some of the concerns he has around safeguarding artificial intelligence. But to me, that was noticeable, Scott, because, you know, I had expected some of this speech to be a warning about the dangers of authoritarianism.
Right.
That's what he had done so much of during his campaign. We didn't hear that as his singular warning. His singular warning today was about the concentration of power in the hands of ultra-wealthy tech elite.
That is a really good point, Asma. He issued this warning over and over and over throughout his administration, making a point to mark the anniversary of January 6th every year with speeches to that end. I don't think he really mentioned it once head on, and he did make a point to say that he's working to ensure an orderly transition of power to the Trump administration, which you could see as a partial reference, but mm-hmm. You're right, he didn't take that head on.
The
instead,
idea of authoritarianism, right, which has been such a, I would say that was sort of the singularly even the reason he often talked about wanting to run against mm-hmm. Donald Trump. One thing I'll say, Scott, is that he did talk, I think, indirectly about the concerns he has, not just about the concentration of power, but about the strength of the institutions, the character of people. To me, that was an indirect reference there to the incoming president, Donald Trump. He said it towards the end that he believes still in the very vision of this country, and then said it's up to you, the people, the American people, to stand guard, to strengthen those institutions.
He talked about, you mentioned artificial intelligence, saying that it has great possibilities, great risks. This is something that his administration really tried to put some guardrails around in the last few years or so, but that approach was not really welcomed at all whatsoever by the tech industry, and it's interesting that you have seen for the first time really ever a real drift toward the right, toward the Republican Party, toward incoming President Trump by a lot of key figures. I mean, yeah. I think next week at the inauguration, Mark Zuckerberg, Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk will all be sitting together at Trump's inauguration.
Mm-hmm. And this was, you saw this sort of over the course of the campaign where Trump appeared on some high-profile tech podcasts. You know, it has been, I would say, a sort of slow drift away from the Democratic Party. And you've seen a Democratic Party that's been very vocal under the Biden years to not only say that they, as Biden says, you know, the sort of the tax code needs to be reformed to ensure that billionaires pay their fair share, but you've seen him eager to enforce safeguards around tech regulation, specifically, as we heard him reinforce tonight, around the ideas of artificial intelligence.
One more warning that I wanted to talk a little bit about before we turn to the things that Biden is touting that he feels like will last from his presidency, and that is that of climate change. Of course, the catastrophic fires happening in and around Los Angeles over the past couple of weeks that were the result of an extreme drought. Biden, it is worth saying, signed into law the biggest climate law in the history of the country, something mm-hmm. that is going to grow the green tech through clean energy, through tax breaks predominantly, signed many executive orders as well. He set really ambitious goals for getting the country to carbon neutral, but a lot of those goals were already lagging behind where they needed to be at the end of this 4 years. And we are going back to an administration, a Trump administration, that is very skeptical about all of those big ideas.
That's right. I think we're referring there to the Inflation Reduction Act, Scott, right, which was just a monumental climate investment bill, a clean energy bill. One thing, when I was talking to the administration in recent weeks about what they are trying to do and prevent, and there was to sort of, I will say, prevent from possibly being rolled back. This is a big concern, right, the Inflation Reduction Act. There are subsidies there specifically for investments in clean energy. And I'm sure you recall this out on the campaign trail. Trump specifically would target electric vehicles. It was sort of a favorite point of ire for him. So those could be at risk, right? Some of the subsidies that we've seen there. I will say in the farewell speech Biden delivered earlier this week on foreign policy, he also singled out climate change and encouraged his successor's team to make sure they focus both on climate change, he said, and also on artificial intelligence. What? Two problems, I'll say, Scott, that weren't huge issues when he first began public office 50-some years ago, which
right.
is interesting.
And let's talk about that. Asma, you and I covered every day of the Biden campaign when he ran for president. You covered his 4 years in the White House. like you mentioned, this is a farewell address from the presidency, but Joe Biden is closing the door on more than 50 years of public service, nearly four decades in the Senate, 8 years as vice president of the United States, 4 years as president. Do you feel like the big themes, the economic populism, especially that we heard tonight, fits with that career arc of Joe Biden, what he's run on and talked about over the decades?
I think we've seen an evolution of Joe Biden in many ways in public life. And Scott, that's, I think, to be expected because the country's changed in a lot of ways. The Joe Biden you hear today talking about the need to make more things in America, who kept in place Donald Trump's signature policy of tariffs on China, that's a different Joe Biden than the Joe Biden who supported free trade agreements, supported NAFTA, right, in the 90s as a senator. The world has changed. One thing I'll point out, I really do think it's interesting to me to hear a man at 82 years old warning the country about the concerns about artificial intelligence, because these were problems and concerns that did not exist when he first took office.
Right, right. He came in the Nixon presidency, and he's leaving the stage in 2025. He did talk about the infrastructure spending that he signed into law. I think unquestionably be going to be the part of his presidency that has the longest lasting impact. But it wasn't rewarded by voters. Voters resoundingly were frustrated by the Biden administration. They turned back to Donald Trump. You saw it with inflation. You saw it with other concerns. A lot of voters, immigration, just soured on a lot of Biden's presidency. He said something here, and let's take a moment to listen, because he said this in a lot of different ways in recent weeks since the election.
You know, it will take time to feel the full impact of all we've done together. But the seeds are planted, and they'll grow and they'll bloom for decades to come.
The idea that the billions and billions and billions of spending haven't fully taken effect yet and won't until many years into the future, likely when Donald Trump is in office.
It will take years. You know, Scott, I was talking to some folks within the manufacturing industry, and what they said, and I think there's a lot of truth to this, that Joe Biden is trying to change the direction of a ship that has been headed one way for, say, 40 years. It's going to take another 40 plus years, right, to change directions. I would argue in some ways, though, Joe Biden was continuing on with some broad visions that Donald Trump had, which was around this idea of increasing manufacturing in the United States, right, to make more things in America. One of the longest lasting legacies, I think, that Joe Biden will have is this idea of using subsidies and government spending to make things in America. It's this idea of industrial policy. Scott, it was a dirty word here in Washington in prior years. Whether or not that sticks around, I don't know, but I think we're seeing a shift in both Democrats and Republicans embracing this idea.
Yeah. Again, a farewell address from President Biden, not leaving the White House the way he wanted to. He had initially hoped to serve another 4 years as president. He withdrew from the race this past summer. Seems like he, the First Lady, key members of the administration are still really frustrated with the way that they played out. And now here he is turning back the White House to Donald Trump, the person who a big part of his presidency was trying to turn the page on, trying to erase Trumpism, say it was an aberration in the country's history. And now he's bookended by a President Trump on either end.
That's right. And Scott, I think really when you look at how Joe Biden will be judged, that will ultimately be up for history to judge. And I don't know that people can make that final determination at this point, because, as you say, one of the longest lasting legacies of his 4 years will be the question of whether he was kind of an interregnum, right, between these two Trump presidencies, and how long lasting some of the policies he put into place will be.
President Biden has four full days left in the White House before the 20th, when at noon he is no longer president of the United States. He delivered his farewell address tonight. NPR White House correspondent Asma Khalid, thank you for joining me in the studio.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to live special coverage from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. This is NPR News, and stick with us for the latest tomorrow on Morning Edition.
Trump says tariffs can raise revenue for the United States.
We will take in hundreds of billions of dollars into our treasury and use that money to benefit the American citizens.
His proposals go far beyond what he did in his first term and have singled out international allies. The targets of Trump's tariffs tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Coming up, the World Monuments Fund is out with its annual list of endangered places.
One place on that list that might surprise you, the moon.
This is very unprecedented, very timely too, because we are entering into a new era of space exploration.
First, this newscast.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. Israel and Hamas have agreed on a step-by-step plan to end the 15-month-long war in Gaza. Mediators from the U.S., Egypt, and Qatar say the first step begins on Sunday. This interpreter is speaking for Qatar's prime minister.
The phase one of the agreement will go on for 42 days, and it will include a ceasefire and the withdrawal of Israeli forces to the east away from populated areas. Israeli forces will then be positioned along the Gaza border, and which will allow for the swap of prisoners as well as the swap of remains and the return of the displaced people to their residences.
President Biden proposed the deal last May, and President-elect Trump warned just recently that there would be, quote, hell to pay if Hamas didn't release the remaining hostages before his inauguration next week. Hamas is expected to release 33 hostages in exchange for many more Palestinian detainees, but Israel's prime minister says the final details still need to be worked out. New reporting from the LA Times is calling into question how prepared the city was in advance of the deadly wildfires here that continue to fuel the blazes. Here's NPR's Liz Baker.
The LA Times alleges that last Tuesday night, as hurricane-force gusts sent flames and embers towards residential neighborhoods, the LA Fire Department only deployed 5 out of 40 available engines. And roughly 1,000 off-duty firefighters were only called in after the firestorm had already gotten out of control. In a press conference, LA Fire Department Chief Kristen Crowley responded.
We follow a system. We did that. We pre-deployed the necessary resources knowing that, or not knowing, I should be very specific, in where a fire might break out in the city.
When pushed for comment, LA Mayor Karen Bass said, quote, "The buck always stops with me," but refused to elaborate further. Liz Baker, NPR News, Los Angeles.
And you're listening to NPR. Ireland's two dominant political parties are unveiling a power-sharing agreement as fear over how President-elect Donald Trump's plans for tariffs could affect the country. In Paris, Lauren Freyer has more.
Lots of U.S. companies, from big tech to pharmaceuticals, base some of their production and intellectual property in Ireland. That allows them to pay Irish corporate tax rates, which in the past few years have been around 12.5% compared to 21% in the U.S. That's amounted to a lot of tax revenue for Ireland. The country's GDP is more than $100,000 per person. The government runs regular budget surpluses. But that could change with another Trump White House. His nominee for Commerce Secretary has called Ireland's trade surplus with the U.S., quote, nonsense. Economists say efforts to bring U.S. companies and their profits back to the U.S. could devastate the Irish economy. Lauren Freyer, NPR News.
Google announced a deal with the Associated Press to deliver news using its artificial intelligence chatbot Gemini. A feed of real-time information is expected to enhance Google's search engine, providing up-to-date news from the AP. It's Google's first deal with a news publisher, and AP says it's part of a long-standing relationship with the search giant to provide news and information to a global audience. Well, stocks finished broadly higher on Wall Street today. The Dow gained more than 700 points. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Paramount Pictures, presenting the new film September 5, When gunshots are heard in the Olympic Village, broadcast history is made. Based on a true story. In select theaters now, everywhere January 17th, rated R. And from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. This is NPR.
On a Wednesday, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Scott Detrow. President-elect Donald Trump's pick for Attorney General, Pam Bondi, was on Capitol Hill today for her confirmation hearing to lead the Justice Department. Trump tapped Bondi for Attorney General after his first choice, former Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz, withdrew under pressure. NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas has been watching and joins us now. Hey, Ryan.
Hi, Scott.
So a lot of Americans probably still aren't that familiar with Pam Bondi. Why don't you start by walking us through her background?
Unless you're from Florida, yeah, you probably don't know who Bondi is. But she was a longtime prosecutor, a local one in Florida in the Tampa area. She did that for almost two decades and then was elected to be the state's attorney general. And she served in that post for 8 years. So she has the sort of resume that would make her qualified to lead the Justice Department. She's also known Donald Trump for a long time. She's been his a vocal supporter of his. She spoke on his behalf at the Republican National Convention in 2016. She served as one of Trump's personal attorneys during his first impeachment trial in the Senate. She also pushed false claims of vote fraud in the 2020 election, and now we see her here as his nominee for attorney general.
And this is a big job, and when it comes down to it, the attorney general's mission is to uphold the rule of law. What did Bondi say in today's hearing about her approach?
Well, she leaned heavily into her experience as a prosecutor in Florida, the work she did there on crime, on combating the opioid crisis, on human trafficking. Here's how she described what her focus is going to be if she's confirmed.
My overriding objective will be to return the Department of Justice to its core mission of keeping Americans safe and vigorously prosecuting criminals.
She said that includes what she called getting back to the basics: gangs, drugs, cartels, the border, foreign adversaries. She said that's what the American public expects and deserves. She also said this:
I will fight every day to restore confidence and integrity to the Department of Justice and each of its components. The partisanship, the weaponization will be gone. America will have one tier of justice for all.
Now, Republicans and Trump as well, of course, have claimed that the current Justice Department has been weaponized against conservatives and against Trump in particular with the two federal cases that were brought against him. For its part, though, I have to say the Justice Department denies those allegations. It is worth pointing out that the department prosecuted President Biden's son, as well as prominent Democratic members of Congress during the Biden administration.
Trump has said a lot about what he wants the Department of Justice to do when he takes office again. And Democrats had a lot of questions about Bondi and whether she can be an independent attorney general. What did she say about this?
Right. We heard Democrat after Democrat push her on this very question. And that's because of her close ties to Trump and because she has said that the folks who prosecuted Trump will be prosecuted themselves.
Mm-hmm.
At today's hearing, Bondi said a lot of things that you normally hear from a nominee for attorney general. She said the department must act independently. The law must be enforced fairly, that politics can't play any part, that the American people are her client. But when she was asked directly what she would do if Trump told her to investigate his perceived enemies, former special counsel Jack Smith, former Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney, Attorney General Merrick Garland, whether she would do so, she didn't answer directly. Here's one exchange she had with Hawaii Senator Mazie Hirono.
Is Jack Smith one of those bad prosecutors that you will prosecute as AG?
Senator, you hesitated a bit when I said the bad ones. Every decision
sometimes
will be
badness
made
in the eyes of the beholder. I'm just asking whether you would consider Jack Smith,
Senator,
to be one of the people. How about Liz Cheney?
Senator.
How about Merrick Garland?
I am not going to answer hypotheticals.
As testy as that was, Scott, it's important to remember Republicans have the majority in the Senate, and they appear to be united behind Bondi's nomination.
That's NPR's Ryan Lucas. Thanks, Ryan.
Thank you.
There are a lot of false narratives around the Los Angeles fires. Many of them involve water. To clear up the facts, we have NPR's Julia Simon from our climate desk here. Hey, Julia.
Hello.
Hi. So let's jump right in. At the core of many of the conspiracy theories that are circulating is this idea, this false idea, that LA does not have enough water to fight the fires. What is the reality?
The reality is LA has more than enough stored water to fight wildfires. Here's Mark Gold, a member of the LA Metropolitan Water District Board, which has been around 97 years.
I can say with great authority, we have as much water stored as any time in the history of our agency.
Still, there is something that has fueled a lot of speculation online, and that's hydrants.
Yeah, stay on that, because I've seen all kinds of stuff online about hydrants. What actually happened?
These fires have been huge in both the Palisades and Altadena. Firefighters needed water for hours on end, and the municipal water systems just couldn't maintain that continuous high water pressure. So water stopped flowing in some hydrants. NPR spoke to half a dozen water and fire experts. They said municipal water systems just aren't built for fighting these huge wildfires. They're built for fires at residential and commercial buildings.
Along with hydrants, I have seen a lot of questions come up about a reservoir, a specific reservoir in the Palisades that I gather is currently empty because it's being repaired.
Right. Again, experts say even if that reservoir was full, it may have saved a few structures, but likely wouldn't have allowed firefighters to change the course of these fires. The big impediment was hurricane force winds. They meant in the first few days, aircraft couldn't fly and couldn't drop water on the fires. Here's Mark Gold.
You can't fight a wildfire of this scope and scale without any aerial support. And what ended up happening is we had two communities that were basically sitting ducks.
So let's start pulling all of these together, because all of these are feeding into a range of conspiracy theories, and I want to fact check them. Among them, people are saying inaccurately, hydrants didn't work, reservoir was empty, and that the reason is there was not enough water in LA. Fact check that.
I'm happy to. A very popular false narrative that often uses anti-Semitic language involves billionaire agricultural moguls Stuart and Linda Resnick. They have huge farms in California. There is a conspiracy theory that the Resnicks hoarded water for their farms that could have been used to fight fires. Stephanie Pincel is a California water and land expert at UCLA. She says while the Resnicks use a lot of water, it isn't related to these wildfires.
Their groundwater is distinct and not germane to the problem. We did not run out of water.
A spokesperson for the wonderful company says we have nothing to do with how the city of LA or any other municipality secures water to fight fires.
Julia, we have about 30 more seconds, but may I ask you just to weigh in, give us some context on another conspiracy theory, which is that the global elite are withholding water because they wanted this land to burn so that they could build open air prisons?
Yeah, that conspiracy theory came up a lot with the Maui fires. A spokesperson for the LA Department of Water and Power said that's misinformation. Pincel says with these fires, there's a lot of finger pointing. She says big picture, it is fair to point the finger at humans. Humans burning oil, coal, and gas is the primary driver of climate change. Scientists have found that California fires are more explosive because of climate change.
Thank you, Julia.
Thank you.
And here's Julia Simon.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. President-elect Donald Trump will take office next week with a Republican-controlled Congress and a unified party supporting his agenda. And as the GOP turns to governance, there are differing ideas within the party about how to implement Trump's vision. NPR's Stephen Fowler joins us with a 10,000-foot view on the state of the Republican Party. Hey, Stephen.
Hey, Scott.
So it really seems like Republicans should be unified. No reason not to be. Is that the case?
Well, basically, yes. For maybe the first time in the decade Trump's been on the political scene, everyone seems to be rowing in the same direction, and that's Trump's direction. Mm-hmm. It's helpful to think about unity looking at a few different groups within the party. One, the Republican National Committee has its winter meeting this week. They're going to be celebrating a sweep of the presidential battlegrounds. They took control of the Senate and held the House, and they had this coordinated effort with the Trump campaign to boost early voting and target low turnout voters. So the party infrastructure was all in alignment, and it paid off. This comes a year after Trump called for new leadership at the RNC. He's sticking by current chairman Michael Whatley to run things, and that's a notable contrast to Democrats searching for both new leadership and a new vision.
So that's the National Party apparatus. What about Congress?
There's not really much of a vocal or meaningful opposition to Trump's agenda or style the way there was back in 2017 when he first took office. This is a very Trump-friendly House and Senate, but it's also where you start to see some of these differences pop up. Trump promised a sweeping agenda on the campaign trail, and House and Senate leaders are differing on how to pass said agenda. House Republicans have a narrow majority, and the leaders there prefer one mega bill dealing with everything from Trump's energy policy, national security, tax cuts, spending cuts. Senate Republican leadership leans towards splitting up his agenda into two measures. Then, of course, there's Trump, who said last week that the final outcome is more important to him than what actually the process looks like to get there.
So that's the party, that's Congress. What are some other key factions you're going to keep an eye on?
Well, the internet, Scott. I mean, social media fights drove a lot of the discussion and debate and detours in campaign policy last year. Also, billionaire Elon Musk owns the site X, which has become more of a hub for conservative political influencing to happen. Musk and other tech leaders are seeing their influence grow ahead of the second Trump term as they become more aligned with the economic part of Trump's agenda.
Right, and Musk especially has been such a key figure since the election. How does he and people like him fit into this broader MAGA group, though, that's been around with Trump for three national elections now?
Well, the Republican big tent does have some growing pains underneath it, Scott. As a case in point, there's been this blow up over H-1B visas for skilled immigrant tech workers. Musk and others like him say recruiting the best of the best to come work in the U.S. is America first, like Donald Trump wants. Then there are others, like one-time Trump advisor Steve Bannon, who say that America first means curbing legal immigration too. But think of it this way, Scott. Instead of there being a winning side and a losing side, the likely path forward policy-wise is a compromise somewhere in between, like most issues in politics. And really, this underscores the reality that no party is a monolith, even one that is largely in agreement with Donald Trump and his plans.
That is NPR's Stephen Fowler. Stephen, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Scott Detrow. The fire danger in Los Angeles remains high today after another day of dry conditions and Santa Ana winds. Fire crews have made good progress to tame the blazes that destroyed whole neighborhoods last week, displacing thousands of people. And even as the firefight continues, residents and local leaders are turning their attention to security and the potential for crime. NPR's Martin Costi reports from Los Angeles.
Security is tight along this stretch of Sunset Boulevard, which is one of the borders of the mandatory evacuation zone below the Palisades fire. This leafy intersection is blocked by a National Guard armored troop carrier, and a resident who can see her house just across the street approaches the yellow tape to plead her case.
They're not doing any escorts for medicine or anything anymore? Not today, maybe tomorrow?
In the hills above, fire trucks are still moving around the Pacific Palisades looking for hot spots, but police are now out in force too. Officers from across the city are posted at intersections here, some in unmarked cars. A couple of streets are blocked off completely, even to the media. The checkpoint cops say they're crime scenes, but they won't say why. Commander Christine Coles of the LA County Sheriff's Department says part of its mission in the Palisades is, quote, looter suppression.
We have made 7 arrests related to the Palisades fire involving looting, unauthorized entry into an emergency area, battery on a peace officer, and additional charges for weapons and narcotics possessions.
But it's not just police that are keeping watch. Further east in the other big fire zone around Pasadena and Altadena, Diane McLean is lugging a wagon full of plastic gas cans up the hill for her brother. He never left the exclusion zone.
His house is still standing, but he also had an RV, so, you know, that's pretty much where he's getting his power.
At the checkpoint, the police let her hand the gas cans over to her brother. The rule here is that as long as he doesn't cross out of the zone, they let him stay. Inside the zone, it turns out his house was saved by a neighbor, Dan Levens, an LA fire captain. Levens says when the fires got bad last week, he got permission to leave the one he was working on. He used a hose procured by his brother, also a firefighter, to connect to the hydrant by his own house and take a stand.
We only had enough fire hose to get us 4 houses. If we had enough to go 5 houses, believe me, we would have saved the 5th house.
Now Levens is sitting out on the lawn, keeping an eye on his house and the other 3 he saved. But he doesn't see his role here as that of a guard. He's not that worried about looting.
I don't know. What are they going to carry, a 65-inch TV? I don't think it's as bad as people say. I think it's just people want to come and see death and destruction. I think, and they're going to get caught up as potentially being a looter because they're not allowed to be in here.
He says it's that and the ongoing hazards that justify the continued security restrictions to these areas. Also, after a disaster like this, there are other kinds of crime to worry about.
Fraud, scam artists, trespass.
That's LA City Attorney Heidi Feldstein Soto on Monday. She was part of a wall of local, state, and federal law enforcement representatives warning that they plan to crack down on opportunists.
Let me add my voice to the chorus. My office will lean in to ensure that no individual gets away with illegal or predatory conduct.
One focus is price gouging. It's illegal in California to raise certain prices more than 10% in an emergency, but huge rent hikes are being reported despite the law. There are also warnings out about fraudulent fundraising and other scams, such as the people who contacted Altadena resident Linda Zeng about her cat missing in the fire.
They said, "We have your cat and we found him," and then they said, "Can you pay for gas?" And that's when I realized that it was a scam.
Zeng says she's usually the one warning people about scams, but she says when you're the one caught up in a disaster like this, you sometimes forget to take your own advice. Martin Costi, NPR News, Los Angeles.
Today, the World Monuments Fund announced its list of most endangered places. And this year, there were some surprises, as NPR's Netta Ulupi reports.
Not surprising with the sites gutted by war.
like a creamy white modernist treasure called Teacher's House in Kyiv, a symbol of Ukrainian independence. In 2022, a Russian missile blast shattered its windows and glass dome. Another place on the list is Gaza, all of Gaza.
We want to choose very meaningful places.
That's the president of the World Monuments Fund. Bénédicte Desmoulards says her organization mourns human lives lost to war. Its mission is to protect the cultural places built and preserved by humans over many thousands of years.
As we all know, the Middle East is a cradle of civilization. And in Gaza, you have examples of those various communities and their heritage that have lived there.
For example, a church.
The Church of St. Porphyrius, which is the oldest active church in Gaza. And it's a Greek Orthodox church that was built in the 1100s.
Much more recently, in 2023, hundreds of people were sheltering inside the church when it was partially destroyed by an Israeli airstrike. More than a dozen were killed. The Israel Defense Forces said it was targeting militants, not the church. Desmoulards says Gaza's ruined buildings include mosques, markets, and irreplaceable cultural treasures like a historic hammam or bathhouse.
That was built by the Samaritan community during pre-Islamic times. Our hope is that after there is a ceasefire, we will be able to work with all parties to restore this heritage and to provide opportunities to people there.
Other endangered places on the list are threatened by natural disasters, climate change, like Africa's Swahili coast, or by the strain of over-tourism.
Adam Renoff here. I just walked up a steep road. I'm here at the Maijishan Caves.
Like these centuries-old Buddhist grottos nestled in the mountains of northwest China and filmed on YouTube by a tourist.
These are the grottos. We are up super high.
But there's one place on the World Monuments Fund most endangered list this year that's been visited by only a tiny handful of people. That place is the moon.
Blue moon. You saw me standing alone.
This is very unprecedented.
World Monuments Fund President Bénédicte Desmoulards.
Very timely too, because we are entering into a new era of space exploration. There is a renewed interest on the moon. And of course, you have the first footsteps on the moon, and they are very, very fragile and need to be protected.
Those footsteps will likely exponentially increase. China, Russia, and India are among the countries now planning ambitious moon missions in a space race that includes billionaires Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos in lucrative contracts with the U.S. government. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From the NPR Wine Club, bringing people wines inspired by NPR shows. Whether purchasing a few bottles or joining the club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. From Cunard, sailing the transatlantic crossing between New York and Southampton, England on Queen Mary II. Dedicated to providing White Star service, fine dining, and enrichment programs. Learn.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.